Hi, this is Dan Kilbride. I am the chair of the history department at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm also the host of New Books in American Studies. Every week or so, we find a book in American Studies that's history, literature, or in this case, public health, and we sit down and talk to the author. We are joined today by Marion Moser-Jones, who is assistant professor of family science at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Marion Jones, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm glad to be here.
So this book, which I should say is published in 2013 by the Johns Hopkins University Press, seeks to link the American Red Cross in general, and Clara Barton in particular, to the history of humanitarianism, to expand the International Red Cross and the American Red Cross beyond an organization dedicated to assisting soldiers in wartime, which is its early 19th century history, to humanitarian concerns like floods, epidemics, riots, etc., more broadly. I guess it's a slight exaggeration to say that this book makes a case for Clara Barton as the parent, so to speak, of our modern concept of humanitarian intervention. So it's not a This is not a comprehensive history of the American Red Cross, but it's an analysis of its roots and growth in humanitarian relief. So, Marion, why don't you tell us about yourself and tell us how you got to the process of writing this book?
Sure. This book is based on my dissertation, as many first books are. I was a graduate student at Columbia University in New York at the Mailman School of Public Health, but I was also doing a joint program with the History Department. And I became interested in the Red Cross because I had been about five blocks away from the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. And the Red Cross was there after, almost immediately, along with all of these policing agencies and the National Guard. And so whereas you'd expect the NYPD and the FBI and, the National Guard to be there after such a major terrorist incident, why is it that there's this voluntary body that's also working? I mean, it's not a government agency. Right. And it tapped into the larger question of sort of why do we in the U.S. entrust to the voluntary sector really important functions? It's sort of a version of the AIDS activist Larry Kramer's question, why do we hold bake sales for AIDS? I mean, he was very, being a provocateur, and he was very angry about this fact that the government isn't responding to the AIDS or wasn't in the 80s responding to the AIDS epidemic. But I think you could take that question and turn it around and make it more about a historical query, an historical research question. Why is it that the voluntary sector, that this one organization, the American Red Cross in particular, is here at this time of national crisis? And so I started looking into it. I had a paper to do for historian David Rosner's History of Public Health course. And I started looking into the history of shell shock and sort of PTSD, and found that in World War I, there were some interesting ways that the U.S. Military triaged shell shock. But in looking at that part of American military history, I found that the American Red Cross had played a major role in World War I. Serving medical and public health functions during this era. In fact, there were 30 million Americans involved in some way in the American Red Cross during World War I and immediately after.
Wow, that's a decent chunk of the population in 1914, 1918.
Yeah, it's a third of the whole population. And
wow,
there were children involved. I mean, there were 11 million children school children involved in the Junior Red Cross. And you consider, I mean, we had only 2 million soldiers going abroad. So, and we had, and I found out that we had tens of thousands of Red Cross, American Red Cross workers going abroad in World War One to serve in humanitarian functions and also to aid the military. We had, there was sort of a pre-existing agreement between the Red Cross and the Army Nurse Corps. And the Army Nurse Corps was this tiny shell of an agency and basically, or not agency, but organization. And the Red Cross supplied the nurses and they supplied and trained and screened the nurses. And then they would turn them over to the Army Nurse Corps, or there were actual Red Cross units that would serve the military. So I thought, again, this raises that question or even underlines that question of why is it that this voluntary organization is serving an essential military function? And at the time of World War One, you know, in the project of making the world safe for democracy that Wilson had advanced or tried to advance, you know, that they were serving this vital humanitarian function. So that piqued my interest. I found that there had been work, some work on World War One and the Red Cross societies, such as John Hutchison's Champions of Charity. I mean, since then, a really brilliant young historian, Julia Irwin, has written a book just about that, the American Red Cross going, you know, its activities during and around World War One. But what I found in doing my, you know, historiography of Red Cross movements was that there was this major gap, and that since 1950, nobody had really written about the American Red Cross and its history, and that it had a really had played a really important role in the response to disasters at home as well as humanitarian crises abroad. And so I started to look at this and to really interrogate this and try to answer this question of why was it that the American Red Cross played and still, I would arguably say, still plays a very important role in American humanitarianism.
Right. One of the controversies in the humanitarian movement among humanitarian organizations like NGOs centers on an idea that is very important to the Red Cross, and that is that to be effective, humanitarian organizations need to be neutral in a conflict. What did your research in the American Red Cross teach you about that debate, and how did it inform, you know, your views on the subject of the need to be neutral?
Well, it really highlighted the fact that, you know, at times neutrality stands in direct conflict with effective humane engagement. And sometimes neutrality is a tool that can enable a party or the Red Cross in this particular case to gain access. But it's sort of, sometimes it's a cloak under which they can operate that sort of protects them in very controversial situations. But other times, I think it's just not possible. And this is interesting because, I mean, this is a current issue. Right now, this week, as we speak, the World Food Program in the UN World Food Program is in Syria. And, you know, there are 100,000 displaced Syrians in Jordan, which is a lot for a small country. There are estimated at least 500,000 people in dire need of food and basic, you know, medical and basic needs. And the World Food Program, according to recent interviews on NPR and recent, you know, press releases they put out, is competing in some places with Islamist organizations. And the World Food Program distributes its aid based on need alone and not based on whether you're a rebel or affiliate of the Assad regime.
Right, right.
And the Islamists are, of course, trying to win over, in the words of one of the World Food Program officials, win over the hearts and minds of the Syrian people. And so, you know, they're not neutral. So this is a very current issue. And of course, with the U.S. government in Afghanistan, the U.S. has sought to try and maintain the allegiance of the Afghan people by providing everything from educational to, you know, actual food assistance to Afghan people. So, and that's certainly not neutral either. But what I found is that there were times when, with the Red Cross, for example, they went to Armenia in 1896, and Armenia now is part of Turkey. There was ethnic conflict there. There were massacres of Armenian people and villages. This is sort of the prelude to the Armenian genocide of 1915. Mm-hmm. And this was a very, a very contested event, a very difficult situation, because the Armenians were Christians, and American Christians were hearing about this because they had missionaries over in Armenia, and there were British missionaries, and they were on the side of the Armenians, and they wanted to get the Armenians assistance as soon as possible, as much as possible, but they saw the Turks, who were Muslim, as the enemy, and Islam as the enemy, basically. But of course, they sending aid to their missionaries, or sending more missionaries over at this time of intense ethnic conflict, was often not possible. I mean, the missionaries themselves, in some cases, had their homes attacked and things like that. So the American Red Cross starts to be seen as this vehicle by which American assistance to the Armenians can be effectively delivered. And but the problem is the Christians in the U.S. don't understand, or maybe don't agree with, this idea of neutrality. And in order to deliver this assistance, Claire Barton and her group of assistants, some of whom are doctors, have to basically work with the Turkish government and basically not take a stance on this, on what's happened and who's caused what has happened, to say, okay, mm-hmm. these some massacres occurred, people were removed from their land or had their, farming implements destroyed. And we're not saying who is involved. We're not getting involved in that. We're going to work with the Turkish government and, in fact, accept escorts, guards from the Turks. So there they said, we're neutral in this conflict. The American Christian groups supporting the Armenians, including Armenians in exile, got very mad at the Red Cross and said, you are becoming a tool of the Turkish, the Ottomans. And one might argue that, well, they could have been a tool of this allowed the Sultan to say, listen, we're trying to help these people. And to blame it on, bands of Kurds and Circassians, sort of these wild rogue factions, So here it is, the Red Cross neutrality is used in an effective way to get access, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, is it really neutrality, or are they taking the side, of the Turkish government? So, I think that was a really early example, and it really shows how little has changed. I mean, yes, things are, the military conflicts are slightly different right now, but the underlying issues, I think, are very similar, in that if you're a humanitarian organization, you sometimes have to work with partners whom you don't, with whom you don't agree, right? Who might even be partly responsible for some of the, suffering that you're trying to relieve. So there's that ongoing issue, and I think it's an ongoing dilemma. And I think neutrality, from what I've learned, is an ideal that's actually very useful, but it's not necessarily historically. Neutrality in action has been much more of an instrumental, an instrument of humanitarianism.
Right.
That's not, to be honest, is not always, you know, does not always meet up, match up to the ideal. In fact, very, very rarely matches up to that ideal.
Right. You know, the first part of this book talks about, you know, somebody you've already mentioned, Clara Barton, and apparently Clara Barton's spirit had something to do with giving you access to materials that were not always accessible to historians. So tell us about Clara Barton. How and why did Clara Barton found the American Red Cross?
You know, Clara Barton's spirit, there's a story about a carpenter in the General Services Administration who felt like he was tapped on the shoulder, and then he suddenly discovered this cache of papers, and it was Clara Barton's missing soldier's office, which she used at the end of the Civil War. And there's also a story of Clara Barton's assistant who, you know, he worked with this medium who told him basically turn over all of Clara Barton's assets to me, and he believed the medium. So in those,
why not?
Yeah, and luckily he got to keep her assets. But I really seriously felt Clara Barton's spirit in that, in the way we all feel sort of the spirits of people who've come before us through paintings or literature. In reading her diaries and also her handwritten letters that were in the National Archives, I had intended for the book to be more a little bit of a dispassionate analysis of the American Red Cross as a public health organization. Mm-hmm. And when I opened that first box of archival material, I came upon these handwritten letters by Clara Barton, and the more I read, the more she came to life, and the more I saw this organization as the brainchild of Clara Barton. So who was Clara Barton? Well, it's funny because she's one of those people who hides, whose true, biography hides behind her fame. You know, there's a rest stop on the New Jersey Turnpike named after her. There are many, many elementary schools named after her. But what did she do? Well, she was one of the first female U.S. patent clerks. And when the Civil War broke out, along with many other people in Washington, she went to help the soldiers who were encamped around the capital city. To provide them with basic provisions. Some of them needed uniforms. Some of them needed, equipment. They were poorly supplied. They'd been hastily called up in April 1861, right? And some of them had been deprived of all of their possessions in the Baltimore riot as they came to Washington. And some of them came from central Massachusetts, which is where Clara Barton was from and where she taught school. And she actually, mm-hmm. I mean, this was a small enough country back then that she actually knew some of them, or she knew their families. So she became intensely involved in aiding the Union soldiers primarily during the Civil War. And she distinguished herself in two ways. One, by going out on the battlefield and taking risks that not all of the freelance aid workers were willing to take. And two, by talking about it and telling stories about it later. And this latter part of Barton's Civil War career really took place after the Civil War. From 1866 to 1868, she went on a lecture tour, and I think 19th century historians among your audience will know that, you know, the lecture tour was the way that celebrity was created furthered at this time. I mean, this is partly how Mark Twain was one of the leading, if you call 19th century celebrities. And Clara Barton had a ready audience of all of these Union veterans who loved to hear this attractive, very captivating speaker speak with a lot of sympathy for them. And I think to portray the Civil War in a very as a very human event, because she wasn't concerned with the battlefield maneuvers. She was concerned with the men as suffering human beings, and fathers, brothers, cousins, and I think that that offered a unique perspective. And so she became famous from this. And then during one of her speeches, she lost her voice and suffered what she called a nervous collapse, and ended up being told by her doctor that she needed to go to Switzerland to recover. Yeah, I know. We'd all like that prescription, right? And then she went to Switzerland, obeyed her doctor, and there she met the Geneva businessman and philanthropist who'd founded the International Red Cross in 1863, and which is 150 years ago, and had basically organized the first Geneva Conference, which took place in October 1863, and the Treaty of Geneva, which was in 1864, which was, as we know it, as the first Geneva Convention. So Barton eventually became involved in this Red Cross movement through these affiliations and through her work in the Franco-Prussian War. Apparently, she couldn't just stay in her, relaxed or recovery room too long. After she felt good enough after a year or so of rest in Switzerland, and took off again to the heat of battle, and that's where she pioneered civilian relief, because the Red Cross movement, the founders of the Red Cross movement, had really been focused narrowly on providing these volunteer groups, these Red Cross groups, that would help combatants, that would help wounded soldiers in the battlefields of Europe. And she wasn't able to gain access to the battlefields because she was an American. They didn't want her anywhere near them. And and probably because she was a woman, she ended up in Strasbourg, which was under siege by the Duke of Baden. And she ended up helping the women of Strasbourg in providing for their daily needs. So in distributing aid to people who needed, basic food assistance, and also running this clothing store where she employed local women, and then in making the clothes and then sold the clothes as a way to to raise funds. And so this was where Barton pioneered this idea of really grassroots engagement of local women, especially engagement of local people in civilian humanitarian relief. And in this way, she expanded the mission of the Red Cross movement. And when she brought the Red Cross movement to the United States, and this was, of course, in the postbellum era when we had a very little appetite for anything military, except if it was in the West dealing with the Indian nations. There was no real drumbeat or support for organizing voluntary brigades that would go to the battlefield at the drop of a hat. She said, well, we're going to make our American Red Cross a little different. It's going to be, in peacetime, a way to provide civilians with assistance in what she called national calamities, fires, floods, earthquakes, storms, or, if there is some kind of other kind of calamity as well. And in wartime, if we ever go to war again, because, the U.S. is not a military power, we're never going to go to war again. But if we do, the Red Cross will step in.
It would never happen.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing how different the thinking was than in the latter half of the 20th century. So that's how she was able to, she was able to transplant and reinvent the Red Cross idea in the context of postbellum America and Gilded Age America. as this national movement for disaster relief.
Now, later on in the 19th century, Clara Barton is, I don't know if pushed aside is a accurate term for this, but a woman named Mabel Boardman comes to dominate the American Red Cross. How did she do that, and how did Mabel Boardman reshape the American Red Cross?
So I would say, yes, Clara Barton was more than pushed aside. I mean, she was ousted from the American Red Cross at the ripe young age of 83. No, and considering back then, that was quite elderly.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, Clara Barton, in the years leading up to this ouster, which took place between 1900 and 1904, there was a real a clash of factions within the American Red Cross leadership. There was the Barton faction, led by her nephew and ultimate loyalist Stephen, and then the Boardman faction, led by this young, youngish socialite Mabel Boardman. it was also a clash between sort of these, again, grassroots humanitarian entrepreneurs of the postbellum and Gilded Age eras, and progressives who really wanted to have the Red Cross run according to then current accounting principles, and to be much more organized and to catch up with Red Cross societies in Europe and Japan, which had raised millions of dollars and were functioning at a much maybe a higher level, which were much larger. The thing about those Red Cross societies was they were essentially auxiliaries of their militaries. And what happened during this process, during which Barton was repeatedly humiliated and they brought out her, disorganized accounts, her
yes.
hat boxes full of paper scraps were brought into the Senate hearing room. What happened was basically, yes, eventually the progressives won and the Red Cross was reorganized. Mabel Boardman, who again was the daughter of a very successful railroad lawyer and the granddaughter of a railroad magnate, and lived in Washington, and became its de facto leader. And Boardman was a volunteer. She was independently wealthy. She had not married. She was the one child in a sort of average Victorian upper class family who took care of her parents and stayed home. And so really for her, this was an opportunity to do something else with her life besides stay home and take care of her elderly parents while her siblings went off and, got married and lived their lives. But it was also a chance to reorient the organization ideologically. And she was a progressive. She was more the upper class conservative type of progressive where mm-hmm. She really allied the Red Cross with the Rockefellers and Cleveland Dodge and the Russell Sage's counselors. So wealthy New York financiers and industrialists. And I mean, this was a smart move. The Red Cross then raised quite a bit of money and became very established. At the same time, the Red Cross became very closely intertwined with the U.S. government in that it would have to deliver its annual reports to the War Department. It's Mabel Boardman's offices were in the War Department. So it became this quasi-governmental organization, developed closer ties to the military, this relationship with the Army Nurse Corps, and also became, to be fair to Boardman, more professionalized and more capable of responding to multiple emergencies, to do multiple things at once, and not really be sort of the personal project of a single person, mm-hmm. a single humanitarian entrepreneur.
One of the things that the American Red Cross had to deal with in this transitional period was the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. Mm-hmm. How did dealing with that earthquake lead to some changes in the American Red Cross?
Right. So the San Francisco earthquake was really the first opportunity for this new Red Cross to test its new methods. And the thing is, as I say in the book, the Red Cross, this new organization, had gotten rid of anyone who had any experience with disaster relief. So they had to quickly find people. And they found Edward Devine, who was a social work pioneer, and Ernest Bicknell, who was another social work leader in Chicago. Devine was in New York, and sent them off to basically administer the distribution of aid. And Teddy Roosevelt was also involved in championing the Red Cross. So as president, so there were millions of dollars flowing into the Red Cross coffers. Devine and Bicknell worked with San Francisco business leaders, this committee, and basically distributed aid to people over a period of months and years. The thing is, whereas Barton had run the Red Cross as this personal mission and had been very personalized and sometimes, if you talk about neutral, very made very personal decisions in who deserved her aid, who deserved aid. This group went to the opposite end and was highly impersonal and ran the operation like a business. And this is something that I think has valuable lessons for current philanthropy and humanitarianism, and is that fundamentally, a humanitarian effort is not a business effort. The purpose is not to earn interest on your money and spend as little as possible, and give people loans and then get them to pay them back with interest, which is, they did some of this. They were very reluctant to spend all the money. They gave people loans rather than outright gifts. And people took them to court and said, isn't this money given freely by the American people for our assistance and not, some kind of business arrangement? And the people eventually, the homeowners who were given these loans for these small homes after their homes had been destroyed, did win in that case. So it was an example of what I think we see in the progressive era is sort of efficiency taken to an extreme where it actually ends up hurting the people it's designed to help in some ways. Hmm. At the same time, the Red Cross was able to operate on a much larger level to be really an equal partner with the U.S. military and the local business leaders and to aid many of the 400,000 people in San Francisco to provide people with some aid. It was a lesson. And actually, out of that experience, Ernest Bicknell, who became then the director of disaster relief at the Red Cross, formulated this policy of what he called need, not loss, that in the earthquake, some people had been compensated for their loss, which meant that more successful business people, more affluent people had been given more money. Right. And really, he decided that the Red Cross shouldn't operate like an insurance company, and it shouldn't operate like a financial concern to the extent that there's so many accounting procedures that you can't even deliver aid effectively or efficiently, that people should be given, basic assistance based on their needs. So the people who are most in need should be given, prioritized. Now, the Red Cross didn't always do this, but this became the policy, at least, that they sought to follow, which meant that, you know, they were trying to aid the people, you know, who were of more modest means, mm-hmm. versus, you know, in San Francisco where the more well-off people receive more aid.
Right. Now, I guess the next crisis that the Red Cross encountered was the First World War. Mm-hmm. And as you've already mentioned in our introduction, World War One led to a massive increase in the American Red Cross, especially in the number of volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
But you also talk about how World War One, especially once the United States entered World War One, forced the American Red Cross really to confront its policy of neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the experience of the Red Cross during World War One?
Right. So first, for the first couple of years of World War One, the Red Cross tried to be neutral. Initially, there was a Red Cross hospital set up in Austria that the American Red Cross sent aid to. And when the American Red Cross raised funds to help the civilians affected by World War One, they were trying to aid people who were both on the side of the Central Powers and the Allies. However, they were first prevented by really getting too much aid to the Central Powers after the Allies started to just blockade these ports. And secondly, there were already dominant sympathies with the English and the French, especially among the American upper class, which, as we remember, you know, was now very invested, or sections of it were very invested in this American Red Cross project. And of course, you know, upper class Americans had been making these transatlantic voyages to England and France and were very familiar with these countries and their cultures. I mean, some of them had gone to Germany too, but England and you know, London and Paris were their preferred destinations. And so,
sure.
You know, there was obviously more sympathy among these people for, you know, for raising money, more impetus to raise money for the English and the French. Now, after the sinking of the Lusitania and, you know, the beginning of the preparedness movement, I think the Red Cross began to reorient itself away from neutrality. And really, by the time the war broke out, Americans entered the war, the Red Cross was not, you know, had not been getting much aid to the Central Powers anyway. Mm-hmm. But the entry of the U.S. into the war caused very dramatic and sudden changes for the Red Cross. Woodrow Wilson really commandeered the Red Cross for the duration of our involvement in the war. There was the Red Cross had a charter, a federal charter passed by Congress, and it said it was run by a governing central committee that was elected and by Red Cross members. And Wilson said, well, for the duration of the war emergency, the Central Committee is not going to run the Red Cross. I'm going to appoint a war council. And he appointed William Howard Taft, who'd been heavily involved in the American mm-hmm. Red Cross and had been president. He appointed Henry Davison, a partner in a J.P. Morgan firm and a big Red Cross fundraiser, and a few other financiers from New York, and said, you're going to run the Red Cross. And the reason that he had these financiers in charge is because he realized the Red Cross would have to raise unprecedented sums of money. So whereas it had been able to raise, you know, a few million dollars, a lot of money for the San Francisco earthquake, it would need to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to support the U.S. In the war effort. To do this, I mean, it couldn't be neutral. And so the War Council said, yeah, we're not going to be neutral for the duration of the war. We're going to do patriotic humanitarianism. However, while the American Red Cross did then supply the nurses for the military and did send, you know, a lot of aid to the military, had canteens that would – you know, provide refreshments to troops at the train stations where they were deploying, would visit the troops in camps. The American Red Cross also continued this humanitarian mission to civilians, and many Red Cross nurses and social workers went over to Europe and were really interested in the refugee populations and in basic public health for, you know, maternal and child health for the French women and children affected by the war. And so in this way, it wasn't a total switch to just becoming an auxiliary of the U.S. military. This civilian humanitarian mission persisted. And I think after, because our involvement in the war was so short, after the armistice, this humanitarianism became the predominant focus of the American Red Cross. And this is something, again, as I said, Julie Irwin in her book does a good job of discussing this. This continued. And just like Woodrow Wilson, who wanted to sort of continue this effort to, you know, to improve the world that he, you know, he saw our ostensible reason for getting into the war. You know, he wanted to continue it with the League of Nations and prevent any war in the future and promote public health and promote development, or what would later be called development. The Red Cross wanted to continue with all of this humanitarian work for refugees, to educate them, to improve their public health, you know, to decrease infant mortality and improve nutrition and improve basic conditions for people in war-ravaged Europe. But what happened is that once the troops were coming home in 1919, the American public was tired of giving all its money and, you know, spending all of its time, you know, aiding the Red Cross. And, you know, of course, there was the wartime, post-war turmoil, and then the return to normalcy with Harding in the 20s. And the Red Cross had its, you know, massive amount of, you know, all of this fundraising sort of shriveled, and it had to, you know, cut back dramatically. And really, just as Wilson didn't see his vision realized, the Red Cross also didn't see its humanitarian vision realized to the extent that some wanted. And it had to go back and focus, you know, by the mid-20s on disaster relief in the United States and certain programs, to other countries, such as, you know, China. It did some famine relief in China, and you know, relief in the Japanese earthquake of 1923, and you know, refocus its mission based on back to its sort of pre-war mission.
Yeah, one of the most interesting parts of this book for me, and I was trained as an American historian, and especially an historian of the American South, was the sections of your book that deal with how the American Red Cross had to struggle with racial dilemmas in the United States. And you really see this in two places after World War One, and that, first of all, is the early 20th century race riots in post-World War One United States, and also in the great Mississippi River flood of 1927.
Yeah.
How did the American Red Cross confront issues of race and social control in the 20th century American South?
Well, so the Red Cross, American Red Cross, had these two policies. It had neutrality, which it widely interpreted not as, you know, just treating enemy combatants and U.S. soldiers with, you know, equally when they were wounded, but as what it would Barton characterize as neutrality with regard to race and sex and nationality and religion. So it was sort of this proto version of what we call social justice. That was its ideal, that you know, it should not discriminate against people or offer people different benefits based on their race, different disaster relief. And it had another policy, especially after World War One, when it mushroomed and developed chapters, over 3,000 chapters across the U.S., of privileging local autonomy. So turning over the decision-making on a daily basis to local chapters. And so in the U.S. South, those were two conflicting policies, because
sure were. Yeah.
The locals, when it came to the Mississippi flood of 1927, we're talking about the locals in, you know, Vicksburg, Mississippi, in you know, Blytheville, Arkansas. The Red Cross was run by local white planters and merchants who did not regard African Americans as equal, who regarded them essentially as labor, as inferior in every way. And so what happened was the Red Cross did provide aid to African Americans who were displaced by the flood. In fact, the majority, mm-hmm. because it was in the Mississippi Delta, majority of people displaced by the flood were African Americans. But they left the running of these refugee camps, which were, that's what they called them, or they actually called them concentration camps. This is before, where it was before World War II. So
we don't use that term anymore.
No, the concentration camps, they call, they left the running of these to the local authorities, which, who basically, again, were, you know, in many localities, the local Red Cross chapters were run by white planters who wanted to, what they'd say, to retain their black sharecropper labor in the South, and who saw a valid threat because there were these Red Cross boats and other rescue boats that would, you know, could maybe, you know, be a vehicle by which people could escape, or perhaps if not, if these local authorities didn't maintain tight control, someone could say, well, I lost my, you know, wife in the flood and I lost everything. And I have a cousin up in Chicago. Can you give me a train ticket to Chicago? And, you know, and that was happening. There were people who were leaving, who were taking advantage mm-hmm. of the situation, and I mean in the most positive way, where they were, you know, heavily indebted through these usurious, you know, interest rates on every, you know, all of their goods and services to these planters, and the flood had washed away the crops and washed away their cabins, and who said, you know, I need a train ticket to Chicago, we're getting out of here, or to, you know, to points north. And so the planters then said, you know, we have to keep our labor here, because this great migration had already started in World War One and had been actually continuing at a lower rate in the 1920s. And, you know, the planters were worried that everyone was going to leave. So they had local, you know, National Guard, it was state National Guard, but local people, basically policing the camps, tagging the people, the African American sharecroppers who were there, tagging them with the owner of their the plantation they worked on, and forcing them to stay. Mm. And also forcing black men at gunpoint to work on shoring up levees, and basically doing this really dangerous work that led many of them to drown. Mm-hmm. Now, was the Red Cross responsible for this? Well, the National Red Cross leaders would argue that, you know, well, it was just these locals, these few, you know, incidents at Greenville, Mississippi, and a couple right. other places. But in fact, they knew about it. They visited these encampments. And it was only when national black leaders from the NAACP to local to business, black businessmen in Memphis, to others who really pressured them to do something about this. They said the conditions were just horrible. That then Herbert Hoover, who was working with the Red Cross then, appointed what they called a colored advisory commission that went around to different camps and made reports and tried to suggest improvements, specific improvements. And while this was too little too late in this case, and also the commission was run by Robert Russomotin, who is the head of Tuskegee Institute, and was really the heir to Booker T. Washington. So he was not, he was a conservative black leader as opposed to W.E.B. Du Bois, who would have, you know, made, in their view, probably made more trouble.
Yeah,
but even Moton made some comments and said, you know, this is the plantation, the, fundamentally the system needs to be reformed. So he was not as much of an assimilationist or, he was criticized as an Uncle Tom. He was not, I wouldn't say he was as much that as people said, that he was just trying to be realistic and advocate for people's basic needs. In the short term, maybe this improved things a little. But in the long term, this began a pattern of advocacy in the national African American community in situations, in disasters in the South, and a relationship between groups of African American leaders and the American Red Cross that actually in the long run resulted in some improvements. So in the 1937 flood, 10 years later, there was much greater engagement, sort of proactive engagement of black communities, mainly initiated by them, to make sure that people were not being treated as inhumanely. Or, you know, while there were still segregated camps, facilities, for example, black social workers and nurses were hired. People were given adequate food and shelter and things like that. And eventually, one of the commission members of this Colored Advisory Commission ended up succeeding in an effort to get the American Red Cross to appoint an African-American executive to its national headquarters. But that didn't occur until 1943.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and at that time, the Red Cross was also engaging in its own, another different racially discriminatory practice of segregating the blood supplies that it was sending over to Europe. So that was a whole other chapter. But I just want to emphasize that it wasn't all just a story of, you know, white planters and black victims. It was a story of both that, but also grassroots advocacy by the black community and national, on a national level, advocacy for the needs and the rights of African Americans affected by disasters. And I think that's, you know, that's a historical lesson. Now, the race riots is a whole other story. And the American Red Cross, just briefly, different chapters were involved in providing relief, you know, basic assistance to people who were burned out of their homes and injured in the race riots in East St. Louis, Illinois, in Chicago, and in Tulsa. And the Tulsa case, which I highlight in the book, was the one where I think the American Red Cross, a particular American Red Cross worker, really did champion the needs, if not the rights, but the needs of the black community in Tulsa for assistance. And in that way, really stepped out of that policy, or it was an exception to that the general policy of privileging local autonomy, and that he didn't say, okay, it's up to the locals to deal with this, goodbye, you know, the local Red Cross chapter can handle this. He stayed and he got the National Red Cross to funnel money to the people who were, you know, burned out of Greenwood, the black district of Tulsa. And I think that there were two reasons for this exception. And one, it was because this was a Red Cross worker who was kind of, he was about to leave the Red Cross. And, you know, it was like any employee about to leave an organization. He didn't have a big stake in whether he'd be promoted or, you know, what consequences would come. And secondly, because the race riot in Tulsa was so egregious and the black community was, you know, the whole black district was burned down, that, you know, it was such a clear case of inhumanity and, you know, people in dire need that I think both he and some officials at national headquarters saw it as a clear-cut case for American Red Cross assistance. Although because they spent all this money from national headquarters and didn't raise a lot of money, in the future they basically changed the policy and said things are going to be, we're not going to continue this. So this was one Red Cross worker, and he basically did what he thought was the right thing to do in staying in Tulsa. I mean, he kept getting pressure from national headquarters to, would they say, close the operation, and he stayed through the end of the year. Now, that said, it doesn't mean that the people who were affected by the race riot, especially the Black community in Tulsa, had adequate assistance with rebuilding their community. I mean, a lot of it was they did rebuild the burned out district. But a lot of it was accomplished without the assistance of anyone else. However, the Red Cross in this instance served, I think, as a valuable partner in these early days of mm-hmm. rebuilding. It's interesting because you can't say that the American Red Cross always acted in concert with, you know, the interests of sort of the white supremacists who were in dominant, you know, in evidence in the 1920s with the Klan marching, you know, of course, down Pennsylvania Avenue. I don't think Red Cross leaders saw themselves as allied. In fact, I know they did not see themselves as allied with these groups. And you can criticize them for being, you know, for looking the other way or for approving in the 1927 flood, approving and rubber stamping the efforts of the local white planters. But you can't say that that was always consistently followed because you have this example of the Tulsa race riot.
Right, right.
So
now, one thing that the Red Cross has had to deal with in the modern era, and I guess this actually goes back to the New Deal, which was a much more aggressive federal and state role in disaster relief beginning with the New Deal.
Yes.
And as you write regarding the New Deal, the more aggressive federal presence had the potential, at least, to marginalize the American Red Cross. But, you know, as critics on the right have, you know, realized that, you know, the New Deal was not socialism. It was not, you know, this big government takeover. And, you know, for some people on the left, the New Deal was a disappointment and that it failed to expand government to the extent they wanted. How has the American Red Cross, since the New Deal, accommodated itself to a much more aggressive federal presence and state presence in disaster relief?
Yeah, so as you say, I mean, the New Deal is, you know, did not live up to the left's expectations or you know, did not realize the right's worst fears. And the FERA, which was, you know, Federal Emergency Relief Administration, the Red Cross initially feared that, you know, that name, Emergency Relief, would encompass all of its disaster relief activities. But the Red Cross had established over 60 years of practices, policies, relationships, and basically a huge institutional presence in infrastructure and an expertise about disaster relief that enabled it to basically come in at a time when the New Deal administration was not, did not have this, you know, the state capacity during the New Deal was limited, the government capacity, and the Red Cross swooped in with its expertise and worked as a partner with state governments and the federal government. And so in that way, the Red Cross, by, you know, being the established expert that the New Dealers who were, you know, trying to basically build a federal government, you know, from the ground up in some ways, I mean, there was some federal government, but, you know, could turn to. And the Red Cross kept that foot in the door during the post-war era. When federal disaster relief became codified in the 1950 Disaster Relief Act, which was, you know, a brainchild of President Truman's administration. This law actually had written into the law, the American Red Cross was still given responsibility, and it was specified that governmental disaster relief would not interfere with the activities of the American Red Cross. And the American Red Cross was still expected to be the national agency for aid to individuals. So in the 1950s and 1960s, the federal government would provide aid to states and localities. That aid would be mainly focused on things like, you know, public infrastructure, repairing roads, and, you know, an electrical plant was destroyed or school buildings were destroyed. That would be where the aid went. But the aid to individual families would be basically financed by the American Red Cross. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until 1969's Hurricane Camille and 1972's Hurricane Agnes that this policy came under fire, and it wasn't until really the 1974 Disaster Relief Act that the federal government took over this aid to individuals and families. And as we know, I mean, 74, that was the Disaster Relief Act. 5 years later, President Carter created FEMA to essentially mm-hmm. to streamline disaster relief, make it all under one agency rather than a bunch of different agencies. But as we know from, you know, the popular perceptions of FEMA, that the federal government, I mean, and it, you know, like anything, I mean, it gets a bad rap. There are plenty of cases where FEMA was effective. But, you know, the federal government has not assumed a role that excludes the voluntary sector. In fact, it still relies on the voluntary sector. What's happened is that voluntary sector has expanded in that the Red Cross is no longer the only organization involved. There are evangelical organizations. There's a Salvation Army. So in some ways, the voluntary sector is just as involved as it was before. And without the voluntary sector, you know, the federal aid would be insufficient. And so the debate over voluntary versus government relief continues.
Okay. Well, Marion, we have taken up an hour of your life, so I think it's time to let you go. I have one more question. I know this is going to seem maybe a little perverse, given that you've, you know, just published this book. What's next for you?
Sure. Thanks, Daniel, and your listeners for being with me for this hour and asking me such great questions. So, what's next for me? Right now, I'm working on a project about the homeless crisis in the United States and the efforts to basically to end homelessness, the response, the institutional organizational response to homelessness in historical perspective. So that will almost certainly be my next book. Right now, it's I'm preparing a couple of articles about this subject, and it relates to the first book because, I mean, homelessness is a crisis in the 80s that affected families, mm-hmm. and it's an ongoing crisis that affects families the same way a natural disaster might. And, you know, they're both projects are really about the institutional and organizational response to crisis that affects families and individuals, and how in the United States do we respond to this, and how does our response structure, in fact, shape what happens in a crisis and how the crisis unfolds.
Well, that'll be wonderful, and I look forward to interviewing you about that in however many years. So again, thanks so much for talking to us. I'm glad you had the opportunity to do this.
Thanks so much, Daniel.
You bet. So we have been talking to Marion Moser-Jones about her book, The American Red Cross, From Clara Barton to the New Deal, published in 2013 by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Now, when you listen to this interview, you will see on the webpage a link to the Amazon.com site for this. So we encourage you to send some money Marion Moser Jones's way by buying that. And a little bit of that funds also go to the New Books Network, which embraces a number of subjects. This is Dan Kilbride from New Books in American Studies. Thanks for listening, everybody.